Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to another episode of Voices for Excellence. I am your host, Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group and proud host of VFE. And of course, this is our Black Excellence series celebrating Black History Month. And today we do have excellence on our show. This episode is personal to me because I have known this guest, I'm going to date myself, for about 12, 13 years. This person has seen me climb the ranks from assistant superintendent to chief academic officer to superintendent, and now this transition as the CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group. I have heard my guest today, Ms. Manola Mason, keynote around the country when I was an assistant superintendent, chief academic officer, and superintendent. And then also, I had her work with my teachers because she is that extraordinary. We want to talk about an instructional leader, SEL czar. We got her today on VFE for our Black Excellence series. And I am proud to introduce my young friend. Before the episode, I said, wow, we've been knowing each other about 12, 13 years. She's like, you getting old. I'm young. So to my young friend, partner, professional, colleague, everything, all of the above. I mean, she's seen when my son was born all the way up to now. He's in third grade. Yeah, I'm getting old. You're getting younger. It is my honor to have Ms. Manola Mason. She is the CEO and founder of Achieve It Educational Services and the proud president. Look at this. I'm about to say superintendent. The proud president of Georgia APSE. That is the Georgia Alliance of Black School Educators. Manola, how are you, Miss Young Lady?
I'm doing well, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. It is always good to see you. First of all, thank you for coming on the podcast, but more importantly, thank you for being a longstanding and true friend of mine. I really appreciate it, Manola.
Yes, let me tell you, Michael, I appreciate you. You know, I've been listening. I'm like, okay, well, when is going to be my turn? I have to get on here with Michael and share. And so I just appreciate you having me, and I'm looking forward to having a great conversation. I'm ready to dig in.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you this, right? And I'll never forget this conversation. Manola, we were at the Model Schools Conference. Mm-hmm. And I remember you had just came out with your book, right? And I remember you were debuting that. And I was like, I'm going to write a book one day. And I remember what you said. You said, oh, it ain't that hard. And I'm like, it's hard. I'm going to be that. I can't write that much. And then as I was going through the process to my audience, Manola was the biggest supporter of mine. So thank you, Manola.
Of course.
We're going to talk about your book too, but we're going to go right into the podcast episode. It's going to be like one of our geek out conversations. So you ready for it?
I'm ready for it.
All right. I mean, this is God, literally, Manola, this is going to be hard for me because you know why? You've been such a long-standing friend. It's like, I'm just picking up the phone and calling you. So, but Manola, for my listeners, for my viewers who do not know Ms. Manola Mason, right? When leaders, teachers, and education stakeholders engage in a professional workshop with you, seminar, or hear one of your national keynotes, what song defines your excellence and equity stance in education?
Well, that is a great question. I would have to say my song would be Diamonds by Rihanna. I don't know if you heard, you have to definitely put it on your playlist. But this song, it really speaks to me because in our journey, in our excellence and equity journey, there is so much pressure put on us to stay silent, you know, not to speak up about inequity or injustice. And there's a lot of pressure not to speak up on behalf of the marginalized communities that we find ourselves serving, you know, and a lot of that is in fear for us, you know, not wanting to become marginalized ourselves. And so, with a lot of pressure, there's also a lot of pressure for us to just go along with the status quo. But we know that when we get into situations where there's extreme heat and where there's pressure, that's how diamonds are formed. And so I say to all of the equity warriors out there watching this and listening, just keep fighting, keep pushing, and keep applying that pressure. Because when it builds up enough, we know that systems can change. We know that schools will change, and our students will shine bright like those diamonds. So go ahead, Rihanna.
There we go. Shine like a bell. I don't want to start saying that. But, you know, Manola, you're absolutely correct. When I think about pressure, and I'm going to, you know, break this down from an analytics term, looking at multiple variables, right? Compounding variables. And when I think about this in the education context, I focus on whether it be chronic absenteeism, whether it be teacher shortage, whether it be the implementation of the legacy operating model where instruction, where learning is rote and didactyl. And I like to say promulgating the status quo, we have to put the pressure on to make those changes, the necessary transformative action to create learning conditions in alignment to Generation Z, Generation Alpha, because guess who our diamonds are? Right? Our babies. I like to say our babies, our students, Generation Z, Generation Alpha. You got a Gen Alpha son. I have a Gen Alpha son. And their radical needs are fundamentally different than the model that's being optimized and operationalized in practice. And those are our diamonds. And we have to continue challenging the status quo. But yes, I got the song in my head with Rihanna, and you are absolutely right, because we want our kids, Generation Z, Generation Alpha, to shine like a diamond. I don't sound like Rihanna, all right? All right, Manola, I was going to do it, but I backed up and I said, no, I don't want anybody to, you know, immediately turn off the podcast. But I as I was saying at the outset, Manola, just absolutely super, super, super happy for the success that you have been experiencing within the field. I have seen literally and seen you keynote in front of thousands of people. I have seen you worked with small group teachers, and the vitality, both at keynote, at the keynote level, and then also working in small groups with teachers, you bring that same energy and strength. Right. And I just want to say thank you for that, because the work that you do, you leave an impression. People leave your session, leave your keynote sessions, seminars, as feeling like they have a one-to-one relationship with you, because that's the environment you create where educational and pedagogical risks are taken. So really appreciate the work that you have done over the last 12 years. I've seen you. Right. And many, many, many more. I know I'm getting old. We always, when we see each other, we always going to say that. But within the past 2 years, you have found it, right? You have founded your own organization called Achieve It Educational Services, and now serving as the president for the Georgia Alliance of Black School Educators, where the national conference, you're hosting the national conference next year in Atlanta. But first, highlighting the work of Georgia ABSE, right? I want you to talk about the key initiatives that you have for 2024. We know that the national conference is coming up. And then also, too, I want you to highlight your organization, Achieve It Educational Services. What are the solutions, and how are you providing support to educators across the country?
Yes, thank you, Michael. And let me just tell you, I have been a member of NABSE, which is the National Alliance of Black School Educators, probably, I guess it's been like 3-4 years now, and I have just been so impressed with their level of leadership on a national level that I said, oh my goodness, where is this in Georgia? How do I sign up so that I can make, you know, some of the impact that they're making on a national scale, you know, make some of that impact right here in my home state of Georgia. And so it's been about 2 years now since we've launched the Georgia Alliance of Black School Educators. And let me just say that the National Alliance has been in existence for 51 years.
Absolutely.
And they have state affiliates and district affiliates all across the country. So our Georgia Alliance is one of the state affiliates for Georgia. And our hope is that as we continue to grow, that we will have then affiliates under the state organization across the state. We have three simple areas of focus for the organization. One is we're trying to create a professional network of Black educators to support one another as they're, you know, in these difficult positions. You know, these are very trying times, and we know that our educators, especially our Black educators, you know, we need more of them in our systems to begin with, and we definitely want to hold on to the ones that we do have. And so by them having this professional network of other educators that they can lean into and support, call up on, you know, in their times of need to exchange ideas and best practices, you know, that's one of our major areas of focus. Also to create professional learning opportunities for these educators. And this is, you know, from the teacher level, principal level, superintendent level, district admin, you know, across, we even have some work that we're doing with some of the local bus drivers here in the Metro Atlanta area. So that we're developing, you know, at all points of, all points along the roadmap in terms of education to make sure that folks have the skills that they need to be able to do the jobs that they have been entrusted to do. And then our last area of the focus is around advocacy. And so making sure that, and I'm not sure about you, Michael, but I know when I was teaching, you know, politics was not top of mind for me. And so right. I would have been much more aware about the different laws that were being passed that impacted the students and the community that I taught in. And so, you know, I speak to educators across the country, and many of them are in that same situation. And so as a part of our organization, we want to bring those lawmakers, bring those decision makers to them, to educators, and share what's going on in the House. You know, what bills are being discussed? You know, what laws are being passed that do impact education so that we will know, you know, and can organize ourselves so that we can lobby for or against some of these bills or laws that are impacting our communities and our students. So I'm just very, very excited about the work that we're doing with the Georgia APSE. And actually starting next month, I believe, we'll be going on a year-long tour with one of our partners, Riverside Insights. And we're going to be meeting with district-level leaders across the state of Georgia. Michael, hopefully you'll be able to join us on some of those visits to share your thought leadership as well. But really to be able to pick their brains and share our thought leadership around like strength-based learning and how we tap into what our students know, you know, what they're coming to the table with and what they have the capacity to do in order to then be able to fill in those gaps versus always coming from a deficit mindset. Yes. So that's one of the other big initiatives that we're working on currently, in addition to getting ready for the 52nd annual NAPSE conference, which, like you said, will be hosted in Atlanta.
Absolutely. And Vanola, if you can talk a little bit about your organization as well, Achieve It Educational Service, and then I'll jump right back in.
Okay, awesome. And thank you for that. So Achieve It, that's my personal baby. It's my educational consultant firm, and we specialize in providing school districts as well as other education agencies with high-quality professional learning, coaching, strategic planning services. You know, we've done work with districts to help them to mobilize their instructional coaches and build the efficacy of those coaching teams so they can be better effective, you know, more effective when they're doing work with teachers. We're working with districts who are interested in mobilizing their parents and the broader community, and working to build, you know, parent and community engagement plans, strategic planning in that area to support those efforts. We're working with districts around, you know, building up the leadership in their principals. A lot of times we think that, you know, great teachers will make great principals. And that's not always the case. I mean, there definitely are a lot of skills that great teachers bring to that table, but then there are some other leadership and managerial skills that our principals need to have in order to effectively lead buildings. And so we're knee deep in that work with districts as well. You know, it's just, I strongly believe, and we strongly believe, that a student's access to a high quality education or a high quality school should not be limited by their zip code, or should not be dictated by their zip code. And so if, as you know, I can get into as many schools and as districts as possible to, you know, help our educators to build on the best practices that they already know and implement on a daily basis, then that helps me to know that I'm doing my part in making sure that all students across this country, regardless of their race, regardless of any of their demographics, that they have access to high quality schools. So that's the work of Achievin'.
Beautiful. And thank you, Vanola, for that answer, especially your leadership with Georgia APSE and the impact that you have in the education ecosystem with Achievin'. When I unwrap specific meta themes from your answer with, around the work of Georgia APSE, and again, great leadership. Thank you for everything. Three very, very, very bold, right? Bold focuses, professional learning, professional networking for Black educators. I think that when we talk about, I don't have the research in front of me or any of the latest statistics, but from what I understand, is that we're seeing a significant decline of Black educators in the classroom, even leadership. I believe right now for Black women superintendents, we're at 1.3% nationally, right? So these internal affinity groups where there's support among each other. When I was a teacher, Vanola, I remember this, there was no really affinity groups for Black male teachers to come together, right? There wasn't many. And I was a fourth grade teacher, and I didn't see many Black male elementary teachers. And this was roughly about 20, 22, 23 years ago. So we're still having that same quandary in education, but the intentionality around Georgia APSE to be able to support Black teachers, create those affinity groups and leaders as well. And but more importantly, you're looking at retention, how to retain teachers. When I speak to Black male teachers across the country, one of the main reasons why they're leaving, and I'm just using this from a linear lens around Black male teachers, and again, I don't have the data or the research to support this, one of the reasons why they're not staying in the profession is because of the limited support that they're receiving, right? Understanding their cultural norms and identities that they're bringing into the classroom. Professional learning, obviously you're big on that. I'm going to unwrap that with you. You have done, you have worked with many educators across the country around really developing the skills in this continuum manner, this continuous form around improvement of practice. But advocacy is critical. Advocacy, when I look at it from a legislative and policy standpoint, and you stated it, right? We want to be able to have a voice to ensure that these policies are equitable and creating access for high quality learning experiences for students, high quality learning conditions for leaders and teachers. And yes, I will be down there in Georgia with you and the Riverside team when you talk about strengths-based learning and ability-based learning. We're going to unwrap that in a later question. But again, pivotal, when you look at the work you're doing for Georgia APSE and Achievin', you're just highlighting all of your expertise, right? And being able to go out and work across the country with leaders and teachers. But I want you to unwrap one specific main idea that, or one theme, I apologize, that I caught. And this is the work for Achievin'. And I think that this is important because I always say leadership matters, right? And making that cognitive and practical shift of principals, right? And you did extraordinary job working with principals. You worked with my principals as well. But when you make that shift from a managerial mindset to an instructional leadership mindset in preparing principals and assistant principals, or I like to say quasi leaders, i.e. coaches, right? And yeah, we want to make that position meaningful and deepen the level of effectiveness. Instructional leadership is paramount. Can you just unwrap for my audience and my viewers today the importance around leadership, like you said, with principals, but deepening that thread, focusing on instructional leadership?
Yeah. So, Michael, that instructional leadership is huge. And like I said, many times when we have people coming up through the ranks, they may be good educators, but that managerial and leadership piece may not be there. Or you could have someone who is very good on the managerial side and they can manage people and things, but then that instructional leadership is not there. And so with the work that we do through Achieve It, we want to make sure that both of those pieces are there, because we know that you have to have both of those pieces in order to be a strong building leader who is then building up strong coaches in his or her building. And I have not been in one school, Michael, that was great where there was a poor principal. I don't know if you've seen it in your 20 some odd years in education. I have not seen it. And I've probably been in at least 47 states across this country, haven't seen it yet. And so I think that it's very important for us to help help to develop principals in both of those areas. And then, you know, work with our instructional coaches to ensure that they are also, being developed in both of those areas, so that your pool for your assistant principals and your principals is rich. And you don't necessarily have to look outside of the district or across the country or, you know, face all of these different shortages in leadership, because there's right now, and since COVID, there's been a high turnover in leadership as well. We have to do a better job of developing the folks that we have within district, so that when those positions open up, you know, these folks have those strong instructional skills and they can lead the building in that way, as well as those strong managerial and leadership skills, so that they will be a full, well-rounded principal.
Absolutely. Well stated, Vanola, because I always say that the principal, he or she, should be the lead instructional leader of their learning environment. Superintendent should be the lead instructional executive over the learning organization. And that is paramount, where leadership does matter, right? And instructional leadership to guide and to build, I like to say, instructional and pedagogical capacity amongst your stakeholders is an imperative. So keep doing that work, Vanola. I know I've seen you work with leaders across the country, and you have changed practices radically for the better. And obviously the outputs are student outcomes. But I want to get to the next question, because the landscape of demographics are shifting in education, where by 2025, I believe 57% will be Black and Brown in public education. So now, with this, or with your grounded experience with instruction, with pedagogy, with differentiated practices, how do we achieve the vision of being culturally responsive? Right now, I think because of the demographic data, it's essential that we have to become culturally responsive, metabolizing culturally responsive systems, but creating culturally responsive environments that is undergirded with pedagogy that is responsive to all students. But how do we create those integrated systems in the AC stage of education with this new cultural dimension shifting radically in education?
Yes. Oh, Michael, that is a good question. It's so heavy and deep. So first, we need to look at the state of education in this country, and we need to look at the demographics. And like you said, the demographics are changing dramatically. And so where you have certain schools or certain districts where, you know, they have been predominantly white for years, you know, years. And so now those demographics are changing, but, you know, the community may or may not be welcoming of those changes. And so you could find yourself in a situation where you have a staff, let's say a community of educators who, you know, first of all, they may not have signed up for that change, number one. And then they may not feel as equipped to support and work with the new population of students that they have. And I believe that we have to start with mindset. You know, we have to allow, you know, give our educators the space to be reflective about the changes in the community. You know, we have to kind of dig in with them and try to get a sense for, you know, what their mindset and what their beliefs are. Like, do the educators who are charged with training these students, you know, do they believe that these students can learn? You know, do they believe that these, the families that these students are coming from, you know, love their children and value their education? You know, do they feel like they can connect with the students in a meaningful way? And then to your earlier point, do they understand the cultural norms that drive the students' behavior and how they act? You know, all of those are things that may not be, you know, the first things that jump out us in terms of training for our staff. But when we talk about changing demographics, being able to really, you know, look at things for what they are and be reflective about those questions, you know, will help teachers to uncover, you know, some of the biases or prejudices that they may hold internally, which we all have them. But we have to be able to face them, you know, and look at them square in the eye and own them. And then once we're able to get to that point, then we can start to unwrap that and unravel it and, you know, figure out, okay, so I know this is how I came into this feeling. Now, what experiences do I need to have? What learning needs to take place for me to be able to shift my own attitude and my own mindset? And I think once we, you know, have our educator training to shift in this type of direction, then we can start to, you know, build those other skills that the teachers and the other educators will need in order to be able to address, you know, the shift in the demographics.
Well stated, Vanola, because I want to first, before I actually get to unwrapping the theory that's aligned to your answer, mindset is critical, right? And one of my former professors, Michael Tushman, always stated that if we truly want to change an organization, we have to change the software in lieu of the hardware. The educational alignment of that statement is we have to change mindset and mental models before we look at the structures and systems of changing, because we could have the most innovative systems, we could have the most coordinated and systemically aligned vertically in structural systems, but if the belief isn't that our students can learn, if we are not reflective on our practices with the students that are in front of them, if we don't value and love them, then those systems and structures and that new architecture doesn't mean anything. You are really challenging, your statement is really challenging the underlying assumptions of a school culture or an organizational culture. That goes back to Edgar Schein's work around organizational theory. But getting back to your statement around mindset, reflective beliefs, believe that they can learn, love, and value, right? Understanding the cultural norms of our students. I want to ask a question that is a sub-variant, right? And this is more on the line of leadership and teacher prep programs. I don't know, I can't say, right, that all, but I do know that there are some, because I examined some higher education curriculums, how we're preparing our teachers, because I wanted to see with the shift in demographics, were the alignment change or the changes of curriculum design or course design, are we integrating, you know, culturally responsive theories and culturally responsive practices. So for from a perspective of the leadership and teacher prep programs, do you feel our educators, this is obsolete of the NOLA's support when you go into school districts, do you believe our leadership and teacher prep programs are adequately preparing our future classroom practitioners to be culturally responsive when we know the demographics reflect we have to be culturally responsive in our schools and in our classrooms?
Right. You know, I think that there is so much more that we could be doing in that area. You know, and even I also, Michael, like yourself, you know, examine teacher prep programs across the country. You know, I do a lot of work with alternative certification. And many times you'll find that there may be a course, you know, around equity or inclusivity or, you know, being culturally responsive. But we got to have to change that up a bit. Like, it can't just be a course. Like, throughout all of the courses, we have to have that focus in your methods courses, you know, in your leadership courses, in the literacy courses, you know, across the board. We cannot just, you know, try to capture all of these issues in just one space, but we have to see these issues treated adequately across an entire program. And you spoke about curricular, like, resources and materials. And, you know, I'll go back to this. You can, you know, our wonderful textbook companies, you know, they can create these resources, and these resources can be, you know, culturally responsive. They can be inclusive. They can include, you know, all different types of diversity. But if our educators are not bought into the fact that this is important, and that in order for us to be able to reach all of our students, like, our practice has to shift, you know, in this way, if they don't have that mindset and belief, then it doesn't matter what we present them with, it will fall flat. And I know when you were doing your rounds as superintendent, you saw on many occasions where you had spent millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars on resources that were collecting dust and that were sitting in closets or sitting on shelves, and people were not using them. And so, you know, in order for us to prevent that level of waste, we have to make sure that, you know, we do look at that mindset and thoughts and beliefs of our, you know, our educational staff, and we have to bring them along with us. You know, we have to bring their hearts into it in a different way, in addition to making sure that we have these, you know, resources that are aligned in that. So I want to just point that out as well.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Vanola, because resources, resource alignment is critical. And when I think about that, I always like when I always say, you know, leadership matters, representation matters too. And aligning those practices, instructional strategies, high yield strategies, specific methodologies where resources that students see themselves. Students' cultures are appreciated. Intentional. We have to be intentional about that, and a level of boldness, because we know that, you know, this world has become highly politicized, right? And I've heard some stories where now parents are going into classrooms threatening teachers. I couldn't even imagine that, Vanola. But again, thank you for that, because we have to continue to push forward. Because when we look at it from a statistical standpoint, if we have 57% of our population are Black and brown in public education, or education in totality, we have to ensure that there's that systemic and critical alignment with regards to using practices that understand and know the cultures that are in our classrooms. But I've been enamored, right? So yes, now we can talk about this, because I'm an author, you're an author, right? You listen, I'm a neophyte compared to this, right? To your book, Teach Up. I love it. I remember I got my signed copy, and yes, Vanola, I did read it. You know, you know, I have an affinity for reading. So yes, I'm supporting my friend. Of course, I read Teach Up. I would say it was, you gave it to me signed at Model Schools. And I probably had that finished 6 days later, because it was one of those you can't put down the book, Manola. You did a phenomenal job with that. But your book, right, it underscores effective practices, high yield strategies for leaders and for teachers in the educational ecosystem to apply to their pedagogical repertoire. But one of the overarching threads throughout your book is grounding what you stated at the outset, or actually last question, growth mindset. You talked about that, right? Now, in the AC stage of education after COVID-19, growth mindset is continuous learning or iterative practices. We have to be dynamic as opposed to this level of domain expertise. So using strategies or some of the critical theoretical underpinnings from your book, what advice would you give leaders and teachers to continue learning within the profession despite the compounding factors that plague our everyday classrooms?
Goodness. So Michael, one of the mantras that I live by is to live is to learn. Mm. Like, it's simple, and I really strongly believe in that. Because, you know, as educators, we have to be continuous learners, and that has to be a part of our core beliefs because it's at the core of the work that we do. And in the same way that we want our students and our staff members to continue and to develop and grow and learn, then we have to model that behavior for them. And, you know, I'll take a look at your schedule, even us trying to get, you know, this on the books. It's like we are super busy and, you know, everything is super crazy. And so unless we're really purposeful and intentional about, you know, taking part in these learning opportunities, trust me, it will not happen. And so a few things that, you know, I kind of do and that I talk to other folks about doing in order to just, you know, stay current, to continue learning so that you can always, you know, be at your best for your staff and for your students. And like the first one, you know, one thing that, you know, I do, I encourage other folks to do is either, you know, be a part of a book club or start a book club. Like how many, well, this does not apply to you, Michael, because you're reading at least 5 books a day. So I don't even, this does not, it's not, I know you have at least 5 books on every plane ride you take, and you're probably done with 3 of them before you land. But for
you know us, me way too well, Manola, you know me way too well.
Yes. You know, for us common folks, it's hard for us to, you know, just find the time to get that reading in. And so if you are part of a professional book club that you either, you know, join or start, then you could commit to reading. I mean, you could even start with, you know, a book a semester, you know, maybe moving into a book a quarter that you are being held accountable for reading and then having a discussion with your colleagues. Another thing that folks can do is subscribe to an amazing podcast like this one, where they're able to hear from education leaders such as yourself and all your guests on a regular basis, you know, to stay in tune with what is going on in specific districts, you know, what's going on in schools that can inform their practice and keep them current. And then also, you know, subscribing to a news feed like EdWeek or something similar, so that you can stay up on the latest in research, you know, around the country, sometimes internationally, just so that you can, you know, stay informed. And then lastly, I'll say, you know, making sure to connect with an organization like the National Alliance of Black School Educators or our state affiliate, the Georgia Alliance of Black School Educators, so that you can stay connected with the people. And it's really important to be able to connect with folks that are outside of your school and outside of your district, so that you can not only share the wonderful things that you're doing, you know, at your school or in your district, but also learn from others and, you know, others within your state, you know, outside of your state, you know, across the country, and be able to exchange those ideas and then bring it back ultimately to be able to help your students. So, I mean, that's just a couple of things that I would throw out there for teachers and leaders, you know, just some, you know, easy, quick things we can get on the calendar to help us to make sure that we're purposeful about our continuing our learning.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that answer, Manola, because I remember when I was a teacher, right? And when I started out, and then also my initial stages of leadership, I remember, well, we didn't have AI, back then. We didn't have asynchronous or synchronous type of learning. I remember I used to, and please do not hold this against me, I used to actually take, I can't believe I'm even admitting this, sick days to go to conferences to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And at least I would spend 200, 300 hours on books on top of attending these conferences, because there wasn't that on-demand learning that we have now. I use this platform, Manoah, as an asynchronous professional learning tool so we can deepen the structures of andragogy, i.e. adult learning, for my audience, so that now you can use a podcast like this. Now you can have access in a synchronous manner to a Manoah Mason or a Michael Connor, right? So we didn't have that then. So now that's why I always say that we have to create schools and districts as learning organizations, where now learning occurs every day for the professional stakeholder, whether that is some type of job embedded support or coaching as you're an expert at, right, Manoah, for our practitioners, our instructional leaders reflected on the data, low inference data, benchmark data, running record data, whatever it might be, to improve professional learning and practices and leadership practices as well. So well stated, Manoah, because I think that we have to seize this opportunity of AI and how technology is being underscored. And we have to always remember, join a professional organization. I don't know which one you belong to my audience, but please join a professional organization. There's NAPSE, there's the Georgia APSE. Now I'm going to represent my, you know, affiliate, the Upstate New York APSE. So please get it. Yay, yes. Shout out to our president, Dr. Barbara Mullen. But please join an organization and couple that with the variety of different strategies that Manoah provided you. But Manoah, I want to get into your expertise now, what you are known for, okay? And I feel bad, right? Because I wrote a blog entitled Closing the Loop on Excellence. And that was underscoring a lot of the meta themes around cognitive ability, around strength-based approaches, around SEL, social emotional mental health metrics, right, that are rooted to disrupt the traditional instructional block, right? So when we talk about literacy and strength-based approach, what does personal responsibility look like? You know, that's one. Another is how a student might manage his or her time in the context of the grade level content and strengthening that differentiation. So these are, you know, some of the critical, I like to say, categories that we have around SEL, but I really want my audience to unwrap your foundational and expertise knowledge or expert knowledge around this area. The goal has always been to individualize instruction and practices where that strength-based approach is underscored in every single classroom, even to deepen and strengthen differentiated pedagogies. I'm going to use that in the plural sense. But if mental health, and please, be unapologetic when you answer this, okay, Manoah? If mental health and social-emotional themes in education are deemed political, mm-hmm. how do we truly meet the benchmarks of excellence to reach all within this whole child paradigm? And please do not hold back on this question.
See, Michael, you really went there with this. You, Michael, trying to get me in trouble. Let me say first that literacy, it is and remains and has been a top priority for our nation, right? Like, I mean, across the board. So right now, I looked up the percentage just to double check. I was still on point before the call. 68% of fourth graders across this country are reading below proficiency level. That is more than half of all of our fourth graders across this country, across racial lines, are below level with reading. And, you know, if you want to add that, you talk about mental health and you talk about social emotional learning, you know, all those things, you know, they're being politicized. And so educators are not even being able to use the resources and services that they know will make an impact in these areas because, you know, they are in fear that they will lose their jobs. Right. And we've seen it happening on a daily basis. You know, teachers are really being, what do you call it? Like they're confused. They're worried. They can't practice with confidence because they're not sure if, you know, what they're teaching or how they're teaching or what if their approach is going to get them fired or have them lose their certificate. And so, you know, it really breaks my heart. Like I said, I'm looking more at, you know, on the advocacy level, you know, it breaks my heart when I see that states are passing laws and we have new, you know, policies coming from school boards that prohibit even the use of words like equity, you know, prohibit the use of words and phrasing around social emotional learning. And I don't even want to start to talk about my neighbors in Florida who are literally trying to erase the contributions and the history of Black Americans from history books. So, you know, I just go back to my earlier point around applying that pressure. We have to stay vigilant because we know that mental health plays a huge role in a student being able to show up properly in a classroom on a daily basis to receive that good instruction that that teacher is trying to deliver. And if we know there's a problem there, but we're, you know, tied up and we can't offer those services, then that creates a huge problem for our systems. And even in terms of social emotional learning, we know that, and the research shows us, and Michael, I'm sure you probably could pull up a few studies at the top of your fingertips, you know, about the connection between social emotional learning and academic success. You know, so if we need to change the labels on these types of support that we provide to our students so that we can be able to get it in and push it through, then we have to be bold enough to do that so that our students will be able to get what they need. Because if we don't, or let's just even think about, you know, those 68% of fourth graders that are reading below grade level, how many middle school teachers do you know who are actually trained to teach reading?
Absolutely.
You know, how many high school teachers are trained to teach reading?
Right.
Michael, they're not. Like, they're not. So if these fourth graders don't get it before they leave elementary school, then they will be consistently battling in school and beyond because the lack of those literacy skills. So I say, you know, there are so many initiatives, programs, you know, resources that educators can use to support students in these areas. And I say, if we have to start, you know, pulling labels off, changing up names and smacking new labels on them, then we must do that work to make sure that our students get what they need.
Absolutely. And Vanola, as you were providing that well-detailed and elaborate answer, what I was doing was looking up social-emotional cognitive abilities, right? Mm-hmm. And when I see this tension around social emotional learning, this is what I came up with, some of the core skills. And this is from a universal screener, the DESA, right? I implemented that as a superintendent. Very, very, very strong, strong instrument. And here are some of the key attributes. And I want to see where this creates this level of tension. Universally, when we use social emotional learning, skills of social emotional learning, goal setting, delayed gratification, practice and persistence, resolving conflict, self-management, and personal responsibility. And we know, if we know that these core attributes, where it's politicized, right? Social emotional learning, cognitive ability, and all of those key attributes are core indicators, core predictors of driving higher academic outcomes, achievement. Yes. So if we know that if we level and lever these specific attributes in our students: goal setting, delayed gratification, practice and persistence, resolving conflict, self-management, and personal responsibility. I think we do that as adults every day when we think about it.
Michael, let me give you an example. So I was talking to some friends about this probably a couple of weeks ago, because, you know, as you know, semesters just closed out, new semester started, and so students bring your home grades. So I have a 7-year-old, you know, he's in second grade. And with him, you know, I really focus, like, that goal setting is major. And so last year, he was on the AB honor roll all year in first grade. So that's why I said, Jeffrey, this year, you know, let's look at these grades, AB honor roll, like, mommy's proud of you, that is great. But, you know, for second grade, if we can get A's and B's, then we want to get straight A's. So our goal is for you to come home with straight A's for the whole year, right? So when I met with his teacher at the beginning of the year, and she is amazing, you know, we talked about that goal and we shared that goal with her, what we were working towards. We're working on homework each night. You know, we talk about the goal when he brings his grades home and we'll high five, you know, yes, baby, you did a good job. And this A is going to help you to get, you know, help us to reach our goal. And we do that. And so at the end of this first semester, my baby came home with straight A's and he had one B. It was like an 88 point something percent, which was in reading. And so he's like, mommy, I didn't, you know, I didn't get my straight A's. I said, but you won. Like, you did a great job. I had to tell him, sometimes, you know, you set these high and challenging goals, and even if you fall a little short, you're still winning. You know, and like, working with him made me think back to my college days. You know, I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. I was one of the first people in my family to go to college. And so, Michael, I was just happy to be there, right? I was just happy to be in the room. And I worked hard, but I did not give my very best. And I think I was a little bit intimidated. So I went to a small liberal arts college in Maine, Colby College. You had a lot of folks that were coming from the surrounding Boston area. A lot of rich families had been in a private school, you know, their whole lives. And I didn't really feel like I belonged there. And so my attitude was not, you know, let's achieve at the highest levels. It was kind of like, let's not make enough, too much noise so somebody kicks you up out of here. Like, that's just where my mindset was. And I so wish that I could go back to that time. I had somebody to really push me and tell me, no, Vanola, you belong here. You are here for a reason and you can do this. And so that's just one of my biggest regrets. And so as I work with my son and I work with, you know, teachers and leaders across the country, you know, that goal setting is so huge, because even if you fall a little short, you're still leaps and bounds ahead of where you may have been had you not really focused in. So,
and thank you for that, Vanola, because social emotional development and developing those competencies within our students, it's an educational imperative. It is an educational imperative. David Adams, who is the CEO of the Urban Assembly, shout out to David. He gave me a research brief, and it was around the effectiveness of social emotional development and school success, specifically around high school accumulation of grades and credits. And based off of this study, this research brief or the study, using a regressional analysis, to all my statisticians out there, where this regression analysis was predicting GPA and credit accumulation, the outcomes, right? The outcomes is that social emotional learning competencies accounted for approximately 47% of the variability in GPA and 55% of the variability in credit accumulation. Thank you, David, for that research brief, because that essentially assures you that there are systemic relationships, right? Or social emotional learning is the proxy for academic success and outcomes. So when I look at the goal setting, resolving conflict, self-management, personal responsibility. We have the research and the data in front of us. I don't see how that is politicized. As my mother would always used to tell me when I was growing up, and I say this to my eight-year-old, yes, Jeffrey and Mikey are friends, my eight-year-old, make it make sense for me. Make it make sense. So Manola, last question. All right. Last question on me. I got you. Oh my, yay. Right. Now, people get innovative with this question.
Okay.
You know, they use three words. I got some rule followers. I got some disruptors, right? Who three words plus. I have some former guests or past guests, they have a dissertation to this. So as I've been saying this for the past two seasons, take it as it is. What three words do you want today's audience to leave our podcast with regards to addressing the social, emotional, and mental health needs to equalize excellence for all?
Michael, you just, look, you and these questions. I mean, you know me, you know I am a doer. And so my three words would be empathize, respond, and lead. Empathize, respond, and lead. And I say that because, you know, we as individuals, and we talked about the change in demographics of our schools and districts, you know, we really have to take the time to understand the issues that our students, so each population is different depending on, you know, the school and even the classroom, you know, take the time to empathize and understand the issues facing your particular students and really have a heart for their situation. Don't stop there, because caring is good, but caring doesn't change anything. So then you have to respond, you know, you have to do something. So, you know, create some type of a coalition, you know, figure out what is within your area that you can work on and solve, you know, baby steps are action as well, you know, and then just take action. And then lastly, you know, lead through your action comes that powerful leadership. And, you know, through your leadership, you can empower and motivate others to hop on board with you, which will broaden your influence and your impact. So if I had to leave your audience with three words, you know, about, you know, how to address social emotional learning, mental health, just to make sure that all students are getting what they need, that's what I would say. Empathize, respond, and lead.
Empathize, respond, and lead. I also got three more words that resonated with me, Ms. Manola Mason: empower, influence, and what you certainly do across the country, impact. Ms. Manola Mason, yay!
And Michael, one thing I did not know, and I can't believe I didn't know this, I did not know you taught fourth grade. I also taught fourth grade.
There we go. Yes. Right. Oh, then I'll tell you this, right? And I say this to some of my superintendent friends out there. They always ask me, Mike, are you going back to the superintendency? I'm like, no, I do the Medea, you know, hell to the no, right? But I will be your super guided reading specialist, because I love some small group instruction and guided reading with that. But Ms. Manola Mason, you made it through VFB. Thank you so much, my sister, really, basically my sister, knowing you for over a decade, right? I'm getting older, you're getting younger. But to my audience and to my viewers, if they want to get in contact with you with Achievement, or let's say that we have some Georgia education leaders and stakeholders that are in Georgia listening to the episode right now, how would they be able to get in touch with you?
Yes. So with Achieve It, folks can look up the website achieveited.com, or they can email me at vmason@achieveited.com. And then for the Georgia ABSE, our website is ga-abse.org. And they can also email me president@georgiaabse.org.
And you heard it right here from one of the national experts that I learned from consistently, have really, really good conversations. and has supported me through my journey. It's just been an absolute honor to have Miss Vanola Mason on VFE. Happy Black History Month, Vanola.
Yes, happy Black History Month. Thank you, Michael, for the invitation, and thank you for such a wonderful conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you, Vanola. I'll talk to you soon. And yes, I will be down in Georgia for that.
Yay!
Yes, of course. Peach State, right?
That's it.
The Peach State. Yes, and it's going to be nice to get away from this upstate New York weather. And to my audience, onward and upward, everybody. Have a great evening.